You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his latest book, The Slaughter, Mass Killings, Organ Harvesting, and China's Secret Solution to Its Dissident Problem, Ethan Guttman, an award-winning China analyst and human rights researcher, investigates China's state secret program to rid itself of political dissidents by executing them and harvesting their organs, and often selling them to Western recipients. Mr. Guttman uncovers this gruesome practice through, he uncovered it through interviews with police officials, survivors, and Chinese doctors who have killed prisoners on the operating table. The book is published by Prometheus Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Guttman to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Thank you very much for having me on.
You call this practice organ tourism. In what way is it tourism?
That's a kind of glib description, but we call the practice of Western people looking for organs and coming to China. That's Western. That's sort of organ tourism. It's a kind of a cheap phrase, but it's commonly used in the field.
And are most of the organs that are harvested are the transplants done in China, or are some of them shipped to other countries?
No, they're done in China. The point is that for transplants, you have to have very, very fresh organs. And ideally, you take it from a living person and just install it in the other living person. So presumably you take it from somebody Chinese and put it in somebody Western, or in some cases Chinese to Chinese.
Who's running the system?
Like everything in China, it has both a state-controlled element and there's a kind of entrepreneurial element. So one of the things, in fact, that the Chinese government has tried to do is sort of said, well, this is maybe sort of rogue elements doing this and that kind of thing. But, you know, let's face it, China is a surveillance state. That doesn't mean everybody gets watched. It means party members get watched. It means the military gets watched.
So it's likely that some prison official will decide, let's harvest this person for organs. And
I think we don't know exactly how. I mean, I make a huge distinction in my book between the harvesting of regular prisoners, common criminals, murderers, rapists, and so forth, which are on death row. Some people would consider that a terrible crime that happens, but in
these are people who are going to be executed anyway.
They're going to be executed anyways. China's known for using its resources that way very efficiently. The interesting thing is that two things happen in the 90s. One is we go to live organ harvesting for the first time of prisoners. That happens in Xinjiang in the region of northwest China, which was used also as a place for experimentation of atomic bombs and so on. The second thing is that in 1997 you have a little rebellion of the Muslims in Gulja.
And the Uyghurs.
The Uyghurs. And that is followed by about 400 people being shot and so forth. But it's also followed by the first time we know of that Chinese officials, six high-ranking cadres, arrive in a hospital in Urumqi and are waiting for organs. And a doctor, who his name is not actually revealed in this book, but would testify before Congress, says that he was told to go into the Uyghur political prisoner wing and start taking blood samples.
And could it just as easily have been Tibetan wing or the Falun Gong wing?
Well, there was no
Just political dissident wing?
Well, Falun Gong was only a gleam in state security's eye back then. It wasn't a real target. Tibetans, they didn't have the hospital infrastructure. I think it probably was the Uyghurs first. And, you know, they have the dubious honor of being harvested before anyone else. Political prisoners are not as there's not a large number of political prisoners in China. Most political prisoners either fall into the Tibetan, Uyghur, or nowadays the Falun Gong wing dwarfs them all.
Well, there are dissidents in China.
Oh, there are dissidents, but
They wind up in a house arrest like Ai Weiwei?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, they're somewhat protected by this State Department list that is handed over. You know, we in America, we sort of express interest in certain dissidents, and these people are rather famous. And, you know, that does afford them some kind of meager protection while they're in prison and means they probably won't starve to death. It also means they won't be harvested for their organs. That's not true about the kind of prisoners this book is looking at.
You say that at first you were skeptical of stories of organ harvesting. Was it largely considered the realm of urban legend?
Yes. I mean, I was skeptical not of the fact that they were harvesting prisoners. The Chinese really admit that. The state admits they harvest prisoners for their organs. What they don't admit is that they were harvesting Falun Gong, Uyghurs, Tibetans. And so when Falun Gong first emerged with stories of this happening in 2006, I did feel it was a little bit of a kidney in the bathtub story. I was concerned that, you know, this was all too perfect, a sort of final solution for the Falun Gong and so forth. To my complete surprise, when I started doing interviews, I was interested in the Falun Gong problem. I was interested in, I felt it was the sort of number one issue in China. So I started interviewing refugees. And I ran into, in one of my very first interviews, I ran into something very unusual. This was a woman, about 50 years old, very salt of the earth kind of woman. And she was talking about torture and her spirituality and all these terrible things that had happened to her. And she mentioned an examination along the way. And that examination made no medical sense. It was all oriented towards her retail organs, particularly her eyes, looking at her corneas. No attempt to look at her eyesight, just the health of her corneas. And she was looking at me like, you idiot, why are you wasting my time with this? You know, I'm telling you about something important, and you keep going back to some stupid medical examination. I told you they tortured us, and they didn't care about our health. Well,
But she didn't think of it in terms of retail organs?
She did not. And I got the chill up the spine, okay? I was the one who was feeling the physical effects of this. And I said, my God, something very strange happened to you. And then I started running into that pattern over and over and with completely different groups.
Now, you were talking to these people outside of China.
Yes.
Could you have had those kinds of interviews inside of China?
Not without getting people in serious trouble. And, you know, in the beginning, I used to think the truth is so powerful, it's so important. But, you know, now I look at it and I say, it is not fair to get people, you know, killed for a book. I mean, that's not right.
How important have the Canadian human rights attorneys David Kilgore and David Mattis been for this cause?
I always say I am, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants here because they were the first ones out of the box to come out with a major study on this. And I think it's a very persuasive study. It's a bit hard going to read. It's written as a legal document, really. My intention was to do something a little different. As I said, I was skeptical about this. No legal language was going to convince me. And I said, what I want to do is talk face-to-face with people, have people where I can look in their eyes and really assess their credibility.
How were you able to speak to enough people outside of China who would be knowledgeable about this?
I tended to go for an embedded approach with different groups, Uyghurs, Falun Gong, particularly Falun Gong. If we all have one skill in life, Leonard, my skill is the ability to infiltrate. And, you know, I've done that before in my previous book with the business community in China. Now I was doing it with Falun Gong. I found that that wasn't the hard part. The hard part was that people take a long time. They want to tell you a lot of stuff. They have to vent. So sometimes I had to interview somebody for 2 days to really get their story. So the time element meant, you know, you go to Bangkok, you've got about 60 people or something like that that you want to kind of look at. You had to pare it down and really get into this stuff. And I try to write the book that way, too, to tell people's individual stories. This is a book which has characters, and you sort of follow them through the book.
Now, you mentioned that the first transplants were of top Chinese officials. Who's getting the transplants now?
I think it's a combination. I mean, there's obviously a nouveau riche in China, and a lot of these people are getting organs. But that's fairly competitive. There are foreigners definitely going over. Supposedly, the Chinese back in 2006 kind of banned foreign organ tourism, but they've never really held to that. And in fact, in my book, you'll see a website. The website just closed down recently of a company named Omar, which basically sets up Western organ tourists for, as they say, for lungs and kidneys and so forth.
So are Western lives being saved at the expense of Chinese lives?
I think it's worse than that. They're being saved. These aren't just Chinese lives. These are absolutely innocent people. I mean, this is women who stood out handing out a leaflet, a woman who exercised, you know, did Falun Gong exercises publicly, Uyghurs who maybe raised a fist in anger as they marched down the street. I mean, this is the kind of people, bloggers, Uyghur bloggers. These are the kinds of people who are at risk, and they're particularly at risk if they won't, if they're very dedicated to their movement.
First of all, I should tell my listeners that I'm talking with Ethan Guttman. His latest book, The Slaughter, Mass Killings, Organ Harvesting, and China's Secret Solution to Its Dissident Problem. Let's say I needed a a lung? What organs are we talking about here?
Probably kidneys and livers are the most common.
Well, kidneys are often, we just can find a relative.
And, that's right.
That's something that is often done in this country. It doesn't kill. Some of these other organs will kill the person who's donating the organ?
Yes, that's right. I mean, they don't really do sort of kidney alone on their own. That's a very different kind of story. That happens in India, the guy who sells a kidney to get his kid through college. You know, some people consider that part of a human exploitation. I must say, I think that's a different story. It's an important story, but it's not the story I'm covering here. This story is about people actually being killed for every bit of their organs. And if you do it right, if you actually can, you'd have somebody very healthy, this can be worth about $200,000 to $300,000.
Because they could take their heart, their kidneys, their eyes.
Their lungs.
And if, let's say I needed one of these transplants, how would I arrange for it to happen? Who would I be paying and where would I be going?
I hate to plug somebody else's book on your show. This is just the worst thing to do, right? But Larry Kidney, can't remember the author right now, but
I do know Daniel Asa Rose.
Right. And Daniel wrote a, you know, rather funny book. In some respects, I find it kind of unfunny because he's the Holocaust survivor, son of, you know. But okay, but Daniel wrote this book, and there it is. That's about how to do it. And apparently they were thinking of doing a movie version of this with Will Ferrell.
Still may happen.
Yeah. Okay.
I know Daniel.
Okay. Well, Daniel's a fine guy. I quote him in this book, but I wish he had been a little more cognizant of, you know, that this is not just sort of cult groups, people being killed. These are very, very solid and interesting people, some of the most interesting people and important people in China who are going down here.
But all of the – none of these organs are being shipped elsewhere, even though they can be shipped pretty quickly.
There are legends of that, and I kind of draw the line there.
Because it's against the law in this country.
Sure.
If I were seeking an organ, wouldn't I be breaking the law just by doing that?
I'm not a lawyer, but I think that, yeah, you're basically – look, the only people who have really put serious laws on this is Israel at this point. They're the only ones who've sort of said, nobody's going to China for an organ. No HMO will cover it. We're not, you know, doctors across the world fall back on the idea of patient confidentiality again and again, and that's partly what keeps this thing running.
Now, how safe are the hospitals in China?
Well, actually, I hear some good reports. I mean, again, Daniel could kind of answer that. He was at one. They can be very state-of-the-art. Sometimes these operations work out very successfully. Apparently, people are willing to pay top money. We have some new evidence that somebody paid as much as $2 million for an organ. Now, I'm sure that was – I know. That sounds like an absurd
number. And who would get that money?
I would assume it would be some Japanese billionaire or something like that. But I don't know.
No, but I mean the Japanese – yeah.
Oh, who
because
would get it?
Is this going to be money that's going to be split among the prison officials, the doctors, and also people high up in the government?
I think that's exactly right.
Well, local officials.
Well, we have an example of that. Wang Lijun, we don't know how he split up the money, but there is a character named Wang Lijun, and sort of people who follow China will recognize the name because he used to be Bo Xilai's main assistant. Bo Xilai was sort of the heir apparent. He was the one who was going to take over China or had a very good shot at it. This was his top protege. And we discovered that after this guy tried to defect, Wang tried to defect to the U.S. consulate in Chengdu, that he, in fact, had run an organ harvesting center. And he personally, and I have a picture of him, you know, directing organ harvesting in this book. And he actually got an award for that and for using two new techniques. And he said, he made this little speech about how it was so emotional and fulfilling for him to watch a organ being taken from one person and put into another and to see the life slipping out of one and going to the other and this kind of thing. So we actually do have confirmation from the top level officials.
Isn't he in prison now?
Yes.
But not for this?
Yeah, he's in prison for basically probably for talking about this. And, of course, the big issue is whether or not the State Department knows much more than they are letting on. This has been a big issue on Capitol Hill. And to me, this is unconscionable. I mean, this is we're trying to piece together a crime against humanity here. We need all the information we can get. Obviously, we're going on faint radio signals. This was a direct witness. He was in the American consulate for 24 hours.
My guest is Ethan Guttman, G-U-T-M-A-N-N. His latest book, The Slaughter, Mass Killings, Organ Harvesting, China's Secret Solution to Its Dissident Problem. It is published by Prometheus Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Ethan Gutman. His book from Prometheus Books is called The Slaughter, Mass Killings, Organ Harvesting, China's Secret Solution to Its Dissident Problem. In 2005, it was widely reported that the bodies exhibit that traveled around the world, came here to the American Museum of Natural History, was using black market body parts from executed Chinese prisoners. Premier exhibitions claim not to know about that. Is it possible to purchase something off the black market without realizing it?
I don't think it's possible to, not in those terms. I think the interesting thing here is that the originator of this plastination process, Dr. Gunter von Hagens, said that, you know, shortly after that issue emerged, he said, hey, I destroyed, he says this tearfully on tape with ABC, that I destroyed all Chinese specimens. Now, I encourage people to go into his exhibits, which traveled around the world, and see for yourself. I say, to me, they look, I'm married to an Asian. They look quite Asian. Some of these figures look quite Asian. And all I'd like for him to do is to clear this up by allowing us to take DNA samples from discrete spots in the exhibits. Because these plastinated figures, they're plastic, but they actually contain DNA residue enough that we could very quickly determine whether they're Caucasian or Chinese.
A caller mentions a film called Red Rain by Masha Savitz, which is a documentary about organ harvesting. But that's not about China. This is something that's been happening around the world.
No, Red Rain is about China. I think it's about the same issue. Basically, it's a bit of a documentary about David Mottis and his terrific work. You know, he's a human rights lawyer. I think he's done fantastic work in this. I work somewhat differently from them. They tend to use Chinese numbers. They tend to use Chinese official statements. I tend to ignore those because I was a businessman in China and I have very little respect for Chinese numbers. I tend to see them as political. So I'm much more interested in the sort of, you know, exhaustive kind of look at refugees and people from the inside.
One of your chief witnesses is a man who's running for mayor of Taipei in Taiwan.
Correct. That is correct. Dr. Ko Wen-je. He is a remarkable man. I fully support him for mayor. If I lived in Taipei, I'd vote for him. He ran into this when he was looking for organs for his patients. He wanted to pay the Chinese price, not the Western price. So it's about half. So 60,000 for a kidney becomes 30,000. And he argued for this with the Chinese doctors. And they finally said, well, look, not only do we consider you a brother, and therefore we're going to give you the Chinese price, but we know you're concerned about the quality of these organs, and your patients shouldn't have to receive somebody else's problem. So prisoners have a lot of problems. They have drug addiction, so forth, hepatitis. We'll give you all Falun Gong. You're going to get nothing but the best. These people, they don't drink, they don't smoke, they practice very healthy Qigong. And we appreciate your discretion. And he did honor that discretion for a period. But he admitted this to me in an interview back a couple of years ago. And it was very noble of him to come forward and allow his name to be used in this book. I really appreciate it. And if he's listening now, I think this is very important what he did. He's done more for this investigation than any other human being.
But you spoke to a lot of other people who, of course, didn't want their names mentioned, refugees, surgeons, police officials. What's it like to speak with a doctor who executed prisoners on the operating table and harvested their organs?
Enver Totti is a doctor who did that, and he emerged. I was giving a talk about sort of preliminary research in Westminster in London, which is where I live. And this man stood up when the question period started and said, I did this with my own hands. And I said, can I ask you the questions? And then I went afterwards and talked to him extensively. Now, he's a remarkable man. It was a traumatic incident for him. He was operating on somebody while blood was still gushing through the body. He couldn't look at the man's face. He felt like he was a killer, and he suppressed the memory for years. He only did it once. It was done on an execution ground in Xinjiang.
Do these people have justifications, rationalizations for what they do?
The most interesting chapter in this book, in a funny way, is probably the one that has the least blood, and that is called The Events on Dragon Mountain. And that is about a man who ran a setup, actually, a labor camp, and ran it. And probably ran, it was a nicer labor camp than, say, Masanja or some of the most notorious ones. But it's up there.
This is the Longshan labor camp?
Longshan labor camp, Dragon Mountain. And he actually, you know, I don't like to just categorize things, but let's go ahead and say it. It's sort of the banality of evil chapter. I mean, you can... people read it in very different ways. Some Falun Gong practitioners read it and they're mad at the end because I give him a long statement where he sort of explains what he's doing. Other people will read it and sort of say, I'd do the same thing. I don't know how I'd handle this.
Well, we're talking about Han Guangsheng.
Yeah.
He told his boss that Falun Gong aren't the kinds of criminals that should be incarcerated. And then he wound up working within the system that harvested their organs. How did he make that move from one?
We don't know that
to
he. I don't know that he harvested organs. I mean, that was one. I think that's where the conversation.
Well, he's running a prison where it's done.
Certainly, people were disappearing all the time. It is the sort of early days. There was a 15-year-old girl who was tortured almost to death while he was there. There was another woman who was definitely tortured to death, but as he points out, he was away on a business trip at the time. He was trying to drum up business for them. They made candles there. It was too seasonal. He wanted the workers to do some other businesses. He's an interesting man. I interviewed him for 2.5 days.
I assume that in many cases people are getting orders from higher up and just feel that even if they're being asked to do something awful, they have no other options.
Yes, and I think that's right. And I mean, would it be worth quoting him here?
Sure.
For a minute? I mean, it's kind of interesting. Maybe not the whole thing, but he says something about that. He says, to be an official under the Chinese Communist Party, there's a precondition. If one has a conscience or a human heart, it's impossible to carry out such work for a prolonged period. He says, once you become an official, it's like jumping into a river. You can't go against it. You can only go with it. If you swim well, if you go with it, you'll move forward. But you see that the sky is very dark. It's about to collapse. You can't do anything to keep it up. You want to protect your area. Put it under an umbrella. Don't let the people below get drenched. But you can't do it. Your umbrella is too small. It cannot block wind. It cannot block rain. And since you can't block it, you just destroy yourself.
Ethan Gutman's book is called The Slaughter, Mass Killings, Organ Harvesting, and China's Secret Solution to Its Dissident Problem. It is published by Prometheus Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Thopate. Did the Chinese medical establishment promise to end organ tourism and then reneged on that promise?
That's exactly right. 2 years ago, they basically were saying that it was all going to be over. They were going to do no organ harvesting of prisoners by June. And in fact, there was a conference scheduled to sort of celebrate this whole thing in China. And in fact, the Transplantation Society, the most revered society for transplant doctors around the world, was completely going along with this. In fact, there is one picture that is missing from this book because it was considered too politically sensitive and shocking. And it shows the head of the Transplantation Society sort of doing a Three Musketeers thing with the top Chinese medical officials. They blocked that photograph. And I think it's interesting that why they did that. I think this was very naive form of engagement. To me, the essence of this problem is historical. Lots of people have died. I estimate 65,000. It's not an exact...
65,000, that's a lot of organs.
It's a lot of organs, but it's actually not for China. China's a volume state. We do things in volume. That's how we make it cheap, okay? Now, I'm estimating that. People can, you know... people can go back and forth about the numbers, and that's fine. I have no problem with that. I give an estimate. I give a low estimate and a high estimate myself. But the point is that there are enough lives and enough people who are missing a loved one in China that it is not appropriate to just sort of declare this historically over. This is the problem with China, is that we keep taking skeletons and shoving them into an increasingly smaller closet, right? This must come forward. This must come to light. That's my feeling.
And why do you think it hasn't? There have been attempts. There is the World Organization to Investigate the Persecution of Falun Gong, who have been talking about this. Is it because we in the West don't want to hear about this?
I think that's right. I mean, I think we have a tendency to want to back away from this. We're the superpower. I mean, if we say this is going on, what do we do exactly?
Well, could we regulate it in any way?
I think there is a way out for the West to start with. I mean, the least we can do is follow our own values. We can't be involved with organ harvesting in China, and that means we really have to ban the practice of anybody going to China for an organ. I think the medical community could, you know, really needs to say, you know, we can't have Chinese officials who do transplants, you know, giving a speech at our conferences. I mean, this is out of, can't be done. We can't train people like that in our universities and our medical clinics and so forth. I think that's just the starting point. You know, I do think the State Department ought to be handing a list of hospitals to the Chinese. I mean, I have a map right in the beginning of my book. It has a whole bunch of hospitals. Now, the fact is that's not even a comprehensive list. These are just things that are mentioned in my book. It's just a guide for the reader. But it's pretty comprehensive.
So why do you think the American mainstream media haven't paid more attention to this? It isn't like China goes unnoticed in other areas.
Well, I think you know yourself that this is there is a compassion fatigue about China. There's the sense that we all know that there's a human rights problem in China and so forth. So there's a sense that it's old news. I think Falun Gong is a very difficult group for a lot of people. Doesn't have a lot of support on the Democrat side because they seem sort of they're religious or fundamentalist in some cases. On the conservative side, Republican side, there's a tendency to see them as not entirely reliable allies because they don't consider themselves political. So, you know, they really don't have a kind of a natural affinity in American politics. And, in fact, a lot of them come out of kind of Chinese politics, really. So that's been something that's held them back as well. But most of all, what's held it back is this, that it is, you know, there's the initial kidney in the bathtub feeling about it. And I welcome skeptics to read this book, and I welcome to read it very critically. You know, but I do ask them to read it.
But some people feel that China also gets something of a pass, not a complete pass, but enough of a pass because we have just so many economic ties with it. It's really hard to come down too hard on China on any matter.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think we can't really sort of say we're going to declare economic war in any of these areas. I don't think we're not capable of doing that. We have to be realistic. We're not at war. We're not going to bomb the railways. But we can, as I say, follow our own principles. I would ask the journalists sort of follow the leads out there, especially about Western organ tourism. Very little work's been done in that. My book really doesn't cover that at all. It takes place in China. I would ask that doctors, you know, first of all, do no harm. Don't come into a situation like this and immediately start saying, oh, there's somebody we can make a deal with. It's too early for that. We can't make a deal. And the idea of saving lives in China is a mirage. China is a black box. You think you're going to be saving lives? I think hopefully my book will save lives. It may not. It may be condemning people to death. This is something we all have to accept, and that's something the human rights community has to accept. The final thing I would say is that within the human rights community, primary research guys, enough with the hashtag activism and all these T-shirts. Everybody wants to put the money into that. This is where we need to do the money. There are a lot of people out there to interview. There's a lot of stories out there. And I firmly believe that that's where we need to be going.
You're saying we should be gathering more information to make the case.
Yeah.
Is this story known at all within China? Is this ever reported on?
Yes, it is known in China, I think, on a sort of general level.
Through blogs? Or because I can't imagine newspapers are publishing.
No, I think it's more on the level of rumor. However, it's interesting that during the leadership crisis and when this business of, I mentioned the man Wang Lijun, who had actually performed these operations, when that news started to hit, very interesting, Baidu, which is the top search engine in China, it's really the Google of China, for 24 hours suddenly allowed you to search the words live harvest and Wang Lijun live harvest. And it was during that period that a lot of people read congressional hearings, because there have been some congressional hearings held on this. And they said, oh, my God, it's true. Okay, so the credibility of Congress is higher than we understand, in a sense.
The credibility of the U.S. Congress?
Yes.
Probably more highly regarded in China than it is in the United States.
Thou sayest.
Thank you so much for being on our show. Is there anything you want to add before you go?
No, I just really appreciate being on the show. I think this is kind of a midterm investigation. I don't think we're all the way there, but I think people will find it an interesting and challenging book.
Ethan Gutman's book is The Slaughter, Mass Killings, Organ Harvesting, and China's Secret Solution to its Dissident Problem. It is published by Prometheus Books. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.